Martin Boozer, you've heard a lot of jokes just in the few minutes that I've been sitting with you people saying, hey, here's a strategy for you. Why don't you figure out how to get in front and stay there?
Well, the easy way, of course, is you draw number two. That's the easy part, but then having a dog team that could stay out front. But anybody, you know, and truly, I really wanted to have number two. I was really, really excited when I drew number two, because all the old timers, all the people that have been around Iditarod, remember the year when Susan Butcher pulled number two out of the hat and she led from wire to wire. That was a pretty unbelievable Iditarod for her. And then I think one year she won with 64, the last starting position. So if you have been around a long time, you realize that you can win the race from either end of the field, of course. But the insiders do know that generally it's a good thing. It's a positive thing to be up front and have a trail. No matter how hard the committee tries to put in a reliable trail, there's always some deterioration. The more teams go over, the less firm the trail tends to be.
Now, you and Roan had been racing the past couple of years and kind of splitting the team up between the two of you. Now that he's not in the race, you have kind of the pick of the litter, and you just seem so relaxed today, excited about this race and ready to hit the trail.
It's a lot of unprecedented circumstances have gone into this start, and the draw is just one of the many, many things, you know, the premonition that I didn't want to tell anybody I'm going to draw two, you know, because that might jinx me. But the lead up to the race is so important. I call it the baggage. You don't take any baggage out on the trail. My crew at home let me focus and concentrate and let me tweak all the tiny little things that makes a race hopefully successful, you know, little lanyards on the sled, the equipment for your booties, the seat for your sled, the gang lines, all the little tiny little things that often get overlooked and are not done because there is more important things to do. You know, you got to finish the sled, or you got to make equipment or acquire equipment. Then that all has been done weeks and weeks ago. And so the last week I really focused and narrowed my focus ever closer to this day. And I think it rubs off on the dogs and myself. The calm before the storm is there. And the confidence, of course, you mentioned Roan, the confidence in the dogs that all of a sudden out of, you know, we were realistically training 28 to maybe 32 dogs each for the racing season. And then all of a sudden here is the, you know, the gift that why don't you take my six or seven best ones, you know, and that's what we have now. The last few weeks been driving very, very big teams, 24, 22 dog teams, to narrow it down to the 16 absolute best ones. And that was hard, which is an awesome dilemma to be in. I'm not, you know, worried about leaders. I have 14 out of 16 can lead and all that. So now all of a sudden everything comes together. And now we got to just take it out on the trail and hopefully live up to my own expectations.
Right. Now at the early sections of the trail, you have the team, obviously, but things really have to click. Things really have to come together. When will you know? Do you have an idea of when you'll know? Is this the team that's going to be first to cross the finish line?
Well, there's some watershed moments. You know, you got to get to the halfway point on the same page. I call it being on the same page, meaning that if you're still within the same rest-run cycle of your competitors, then you have a shot. You got to get to Unalakleet, your hometown, at the same page within a rest run cycle of the front. So we definitely plan on that. That's the goal. And from experience, we know that if you're not there, then you're just an also-ran. So I just need to be able to take it out on the trail. And as always, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And I was working pretty hard.
Your very first race that you won, I remember this, in Unalakleet, and you came through and you had these little dogs, these tiny skinny dogs that no one had ever really seen up front before. And you kind of changed the dog, the Iditarod dog, in that year. You crossed the finish line in first place, showing that, you know what, Boozer has tiny dogs, but they can run and they can win. And it changed the Iditarod sled dog. Talk about that. What does that mean for you? How did you even know that these dogs could do it?
Very good observation, and true. It actually goes back to, because it was 1983, I had an epiphany when I was standing at the near the finish line of the Fur Rendezvous. And I call them the speed dogs. People call them sprint dogs. But I don't think a rendezvous, you know, 325-mile heat is really a sprint. It's a speed race. And I was watching some of those George Atla and Gareth Wright dogs. And I remember one blonde dog in particular that I came... that came flying across the finish line in a fly, what I call a flying trot. It's a diagonal displacement gait, but the dog was airborne in between strides. And leading up to that epiphany, I had done two Iditarods with Siberian Huskies in a slow motion mode, in a trotting gait. And everybody else was running the Iditarod with this similar gaited kind of dog, short coupled, hairy, kind of trapline type look. When I looked at that dog coming across the finish line so fast in a gait that was unusual for Iditarod, I in my head said, these dogs are going to win the Iditarod. And from then on, obviously it took a few years. I had finished well, but I had never won until 1992, which in hindsight, of course, was maybe good because it gave me almost 10 years of what I call a genetic advantage. So 92, 94, and to some degree 97, I had a superior team because everybody else was still playing catch-up genetically. And to me, I appreciate your observation because to me now it's so cool to see 30 or 40 teams with virtually almost identical dogs. You know, there might be even more. Almost all the racing dogs now have that same beautiful long-legged body, stride, and we've been breeding for what we call multi-gated dogs. They can't only trot, they can also lope, they can canter, they can pace. So we have become much more insightful and tolerant to the modern dog. And to me, that's fulfilling. That's really... I have never really talked much about changing the breed, but after 30 years, I start taking credit for it.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything else you'd like to share with the folks of Western Alaska?
No, it's great to... it's not only a race where every moment, every second, and every decision counts. It's also a cultural experience. You know, it's wonderful to come into the hospitality of first the Athabascan and then the Inupiaq villages. I mean, it's just wonderful to... It's a trip... It's a cultural trip as well, you know, and I get to eat the local foods. I love the Eskimo diets. I have incorporated it in my operation because it's smart. It makes sense, you know, and it's just wonderful. So it's a multifaceted trip. The race, of course, matters, but also the trip down the trail is very important as well.
All right. Well, thanks, Martin.
Thanks.